Good evening, everyone. My name is Simon Jones. I'm the interim dean of Lincoln, and it's my very great pleasure to welcome you all to this lecture. Just to say a bit about my role, I'm the interim dean here because I'm here on a 9-month secondment. I'm 7 months in. My expiry date is Christmas Day. And then after that, I go back to my other life, which is a chaplain of Merton College, Oxford, where I've been for the last 20 or so years. So a very warm welcome to the 7th in the Lincoln Cathedral Lecture Series. Within this series of talks, we're asking, how can common good theology help us play our part in spiritual and civic renewal? And we appreciate very much the partnership with Together for the Common Good. It's part of our wider Lincoln Cathedral Common Good project, helping us to develop our civic and social engagement. One of the things I've been trying to do over the past 7 months here is to look for opportunities to strengthen existing partnerships we have within the local community and also to develop new ones. And this fits perfectly with that ambition that we have in the cathedral. Jenny, over to you.
Thanks, Simon. So we're also delighted to be partnering with you to put on this series. In fact, these talks are for everyone, and they're to help us reflect on how God calls us out of the deep malaise in which we find ourselves towards spiritual and civic renewal. So whether it's about human freedom, the economy, work, people and planet, civic and political life, or social peace, all of these areas need our attention and this time of profound change. So for those watching, the recordings of previous lectures are online at togetherforthecommongood.co.uk. And we're featuring speakers from different traditions, each of whom draws on the tradition of Catholic social teaching to explore how Christian theology can be a blessing on public life. And tonight, we're going to hear from Professor Alison Milbank, who is uniquely equipped to take a creative approach to what has become an increasingly polarised debate. Environmental concerns are often perceived as Western or middle class by poor and working people, which is why there is growing resistance to the increasingly technocratic top-down approaches taken by governments and big corporations. So to avoid further alienation, we need to explore this from a common good approach that balances the interests of the earth with local agency and livelihoods. Now, Catholic social thought talks about integral ecology, which demands that we think relationally with nature, with each other, and with God. And it requires us to identify ways that integrate environmental considerations with a coherent economic and industrial strategy that enables communities to thrive. So I'm excited about what this evening might provoke. But before we get started, I would just like to thank CCLA for hosting this evening. CCLA is our longtime partner, an amazing supportive friend to Together for the Common Good over many years, including my work in designing this series of lectures. So CCLA is the UK's leading sustainability fund manager for charities, faith and public sector organisations with a long history of managing assets for Christian organisations. And within that, they have an investment fund specifically aligned with Catholic social teaching, especially for Catholic charities, churches, dioceses, schools and religious orders. They've also launched a Better World Faith Consistent Fund for individual investors, and they provide the secretariat for the Church's Investors Group, helping Christian investors generate faith-aligned policies, for example, with modern-day slavery, cost of living crisis, mental health and climate change. So for those of you watching online, we'll be taking questions later. So if you're watching on Zoom or Facebook or YouTube, please do enter questions. And at this stage, I'm going to hand over to Simon to introduce Alison.
Thanks very much. So I'm really delighted to introduce Alison Milbank. Alison, as many of you will know, is Professor of Theology and Literature at the University of Nottingham. She's also canon theologian and a priest vicar at Southall Minster. She's the author of many books, the latest of which is The Once and Future Parish. I think Alison brings a unique combination of perspectives to this, allowing her to shed light on the complex issues in this increasingly heated debate about how to combat climate change. Her expertise in Christian theology and Catholic social teaching enables her to open up an integral ecology discussion on the subject of climate, injustice, and social injustice. And as a pastor and priest and a lover of the English pastoral tradition, and as co-founder of the Save the Parish movement, she's uniquely equipped to address how the parish can be part of the solution. Alison, we're delighted to have you with us this evening. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. And it's a great pleasure to speak to these diverse audiences and to mine the riches of Christian social and ecological thinking on the important topic of a just world. But it's also daunting, particularly the people around me in this room and their expertise, and also the expertise of the speakers who preceded me in this lecture series, but also because the stakes in the topics looked at have been raised as we move from the person to work and the economy and now the world. The challenges that face us are dizzying in their range and difficulty, and I am no climate change expert or scientist, but I do believe that we have some theological resources, treasures old and new, that can be of substantial benefit in guiding us through the complexities. I'm going to commend four key elements of Catholic social teaching: the dignity of the person with rights and responsibilities and duties, solidarity, subsidiarity, and the common good itself, which have synergies with my own Anglican social traditions. It's timely to address the topic of justice for humankind and for the natural world in the context of a national conversation in which the needs of people and nature are perceived to be in competition. For example, speed limits in built-up areas, EULA's low emission zones, and the Prime Minister's retreat from some green policies with the aim of helping people struggling with the cost of living crisis. We can all imagine situations where the needs of the poor and those of the environment can clash. And you can separate humans further into rich and poor here. There are areas of present-day Jakarta, for example, where the rich live in gated enclaves of pollution-free, insulated, environmentally protected buildings with their own generators and electric grids, with the poor in shacks up against their walls, in toxic living conditions, no sanitation, and breathing polluted air. Climate change may create even more disadvantaged global south, with extreme weather conditions putting millions of lives at risk, while the rich north find ways to protect themselves. So do we live in a world in which interest groups always compete for resources, in which goods such as prosperity and environmental concern are at odds? Do we deny developing countries the benefits industrial and technological advances have brought our own, but at the cost of global temperatures rising to even more dangerous levels? For a 1.5 degree rise is now anticipated as early as the mid-2030s. There have been temperature shifts and ice ages 8 times in the world's history, but at no point did the percentage of carbon dioxide rise to 300 parts per million, and that only once. The figure in May 2023 was 424. There can be no doubt that humankind and our energy use have created this unprecedented situation, which has no parallel. Well, such figures as I've just given can terrify us, and the intractability of the problem make us just freeze or accept our situation as fated. Some extreme evangelical groups even argue from this unprecedented situation for the proximity of the apocalypse, and even, if you get even more extreme, that you should hurry it along. And yet we do have theological resources to help us take a less tragic view. The central idea that should drive our action is something that Anglicans will have heard Sunday by Sunday since the liturgical revisions of the 1970s, in which we pray in our intercessions that we may honour one another and seek the common good. The common good is not the greater good of utilitarianism, in which the desires and needs of the individual might be negated so that society's good might be served, the greatest good of the greatest number. Utilitarianism might say that the quarter of the world's population who live in coastal areas might just have to accept the loss of their homes caused by rising sea levels if the energy needs of the majority are to be met. By contrast, the common good believes that true goods are those we all share, individually and together. As the 16th century Anglican theologian Richard Hooker puts it in his Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity, the good which is proper unto each man belongeth to the common good of all as a part of the whole perfection. The idea goes back to the Greek philosophical world, so that in Plato, a flourishing person and a flourishing polity alike were the result of the full perfection and development of each part of society or part of a person, working interdependently and ordered by justice. Hooker also looks back to Aristotle's Politics, where he argues that political life is aimed at living well and sharing virtues and goals which are not divided by being shared. And to Thomas Aquinas, who argues that a law is that which serves the common good and helps direct us to our end or goal, which is union with God. It is this which also undergirds Catholic social teaching today, vividly expressed by Pope Francis during the pandemic in 2020. I quote, "The coronavirus is showing us that each person's true good is a common good, not only individual, and vice versa, the common good is a true good for the person. If a person only seeks his or her own good, that person is selfish. Instead, a person is more of a person when his or her good is open to everyone, when it is shared. Health, in addition to being an individual good, is also a public good. A healthy society is one that takes care of everyone's health." What all these thinkers share is a belief that the good of you and me as individuals is interconnected. As Jeremiah writes, "Seek the welfare of the city, for in its welfare you will find your own welfare." Or as Dante's formerly rivalrous and ambitious souls now greet a newcomer in paradise in the Divine Comedy, "Here comes one who will increase our loves." More people arriving in heaven does not mean a smaller degree of blessedness, but it's multiplication. True goods are not lessened by being shared. This suggests there is a possibility for policies involving shared good rather than competitive goods, that my good is actually constituted partly by yours. Martin Luther King put it to his children when talking of giving them an excellent education when others do not enjoy such a benefit, said, "You will never be what you ought to be until they are what they ought to be." We are all diminished by poverty, by inequality, by the degradation of the earth, air, and seas. Well, as Jenny said, the common good is an idea which Christians share with people of other faiths, who hold to a transcendent good which stands over against us and calls us to account, to whom we orient our actions and understanding. It links to ideas of natural law, what C.S. Lewis called the Tao in his book The Abolition of Man, the fit between human beings and the world, which gives us our limits and offers a source of value beyond the self. Even to claim we have limits is to go against the human self-aggrandisement that fuels a growth agenda. So how can then this ecumenical theology of the common good lead us to make better decisions? You can see a simple example in one policy that Rishi Sunak cancelled this autumn, which was the requirement for those renting out accommodation to raise their properties to a higher energy efficient level. If landlords insulated their properties better, then their tenants would be warmer and pay lower heating bills. It would cost the landlords money, but they would attain a higher energy efficiency rating and attract more tenants, as well as own a property worth more if they sold it. The action would save money for the NHS because warmer, less damp homes would prevent some illnesses. All this before we begin to assess the savings in energy consumption and lowering of carbon emissions. Now, it's true that some insulation materials are made from burning fossil fuels, but wood fibre and wool are natural substitutes. Indeed, our upland sheep farmers often resort to destroying wool that is not of high enough quality for garments, so there would be an economic gain for them too. And even taking the environmental costs of insulating homes into account, the whole point of insulation is it prevents the need for heating. I have neighbours in modern, well-insulated houses who rarely put their central heating on at all. And as temperatures rise and we have heat waves of intensifying ferocity, well-insulated buildings keep cooler too, obviating the need for air conditioning, and also people are beginning to be affected in their health by the heat. In the United Kingdom, insulating buildings would save 14% in greenhouse gas emissions, but in the USA it would save a massive 40%. Poor people would keep warmer and be less prone to ill health, and that costs you a lot of money. You can't even afford to be ill if you're poor in America. They would have more money to feed their families, and we should all benefit in direct and indirect ways. It is a virtuous circle in which the needs of individuals, groups, and society are all served and good is shared. Well as stressing the communal, common good thinking puts equal emphasis on personal responsibility. Popes Leo XIII and Pius XI addressed the rise of Marxism in later Soviet Russia by charting a middle way between capitalist individualism on the one hand and communist collectivism and denigration of the individual person on the other. So Rerum Novarum, way back in the 19th century, states, "All people have equal dignity regardless of social class, and a good government protects the rights and cares for the needs of all its members, rich and poor. Everyone can contribute to the common good in some way." An example of a virtuous circle that embodies this principle of each person valued and contributing is a primary school rebuilding in Welshpool. Not only does this school have solar panels and heat pumps, they're a minor form of its heating. Its major source is the children, the heat they give off, which is magnified through levels of triple glazing and insulation with a ventilation system which distributes the warm air. Kiddiewatts, as they call it, powers the system, giving the children a direct sense of their contribution to the social good. They gain a sense of agency and dignity. The sense of the dignity of the human person is a central pillar of Christianity, like other faiths, which should be at the heart of our policies to make a juster world. While droughts in East Africa have long been a common feature, climate change has made them, even by a conservative estimate, 100 times worse, causing destitution, migration, and death. Subsistence farmers in those regions are the victims of the choices and actions of people in developed countries who consume so much more and create these conditions. Now, there needs to be restitution at the international and government level, but it's equally important that sufferers are not seen as purely passive victims and are enabled to flourish with freedom and agency. Desertification of these areas can be improved by quite simple changes in practice, and these are being developed by the local farmers themselves. Particularly, the most famous is Yauba Sawadogo in Burkina Faso, whose initiatives are being exported across the region. Yaoba developed the traditional farming technique of zai, which involves digging holes in the dry season to catch water and concentrate compost. He decided to add manure and other kind of waste products to the holes and made much bigger holes, so that even without rain, the crops grew. The holes attract termites as well, and this makes the hole, they break up the soil, and this allows the water to be distributed and also kept. So the water level rises 5 times as much, and in some areas, 17 times as much. And yields can increase by 500%. So that you can actually end up selling your produce as well as using it for yourself. Another traditional technique he developed with others was the laying of rows of stones close to the crops to retain what water does fall. And he planted trees, because the loss of trees has been such a cause of soil erosion and depletion in the area. And this too increased crop yields in dry times. In this way, local farmers are finding their own solutions to their problems in ways that work with nature and are sustainable and make them more independent. You know, not even buying in fertilizer, they're using people's waste products. In Niger, where farming is 40% of the gross national product, one result of drought and desertification has been sporadic violence between competing groups, with mainly male herdsmen competing with female pastoralists. Another cause of tension has been the arrival of refugees from Mali, again competing for scarce resources and making desertification worse by cutting down tree cover for firewood. Two projects in partnership with aid agencies have enabled cooperation rather than competition. In new market gardening techniques, in which drip irrigation is used to minimize evaporation, which is combined with new ways of preserving water. Homes are also now being built for the refugees, which will prevent the need for firewood and are equally available for local people. This is through a new brick-making method they have devised, which adds tiny amounts of dry cement to soil. Houses built from these bricks need no water for cement mortar, and the bricks need no energy for firing, unlike the older clay variety they used to use. This brings employment, shelter, environmental gain, and community cohesion as everyone works together. Human flourishing and the flourishing of nature are united, and there is work, which, as John Crudders reminded us in the last lecture, is central to our creativity and dignity as persons. Although there is much talk in climate change policies about a universal basic income, assuming lack of work in the future, when automation may put many people out of employment, this does not really chime with a Christian view of the person as having both rights and duties as a responsible citizen, or support the dignity of work, which Quadragesimo Anno so emphasised. A better model was proposed by Anthony Atkinson in 1996. Participant income, or PI, ensures a regular salary on the understanding that a person contributes in some way to society. People might offer care of the elderly or contribute to environmental projects that do not have direct economic value and so are not being done. Although PI has been criticised as a form of forced labour and thus a contravention of human rights, be interesting to hear what you think, the model does allow for choice of in what area of life a person will contribute. Heikki Hilamo, a Finnish economist, has suggested adding skills or language training and other education to the mix so that people are not trapped in low-skill activities. Such participation will have so many benefits: mental health, friendship, worth and direction, and again, dignity. And with environmental projects at its heart, the PI will have ecological value. You can make an analogy here with food banks, bring it back to today. There is no questioning the present need for such charitable endeavours, and faith groups are hugely involved in supporting their work. While I admire people who run such helpful initiatives, we also need to ask ourselves what we are doing. Most of my life, people in Britain could feed themselves. And I asked a primary school teacher who was retired the other day and had worked in quite challenging areas all her life. And she said, this is a recent phenomenon in her experience. Yet we are now in a situation in which even people in work are often in need of food banks. Are we making it too easy for politicians by providing food which people should be able to afford for themselves? The Trussell Trust is acutely aware of the ambiguities of their work and have made representations to government about this. Yet they're stuck, fulfilling a need that should not be there, but ensuring that children do not go to school hungry. And it's demeaning for those who have to make use of food banks. A better model that accords with the kind of theology that I have been describing began in Stockport and has been popular in many parts of the United Kingdom. It's the food pantry. Your local pantry is now available nationwide in partnership between Skylight, I think it's a housing association, who developed the idea, and Church Action on Poverty. People become members, as for an ordinary cooperative, and can then buy food, often donated by farmers and supermarkets, at greatly reduced prices. Like PI, this enables a sense of human dignity and reciprocity as people give and receive. Members can both use the service and support it with their labour if they want. While food banks are often places of comfort and support, food pantries have this built into their cooperative structure and often become the basis for a wider range of community activities. Again, individuals can learn how they can serve the common good and their own needs and have dignity in feeling they're making a contribution. For this is the logic of the so-called golden rule, which Christianity inherited from Judaism. Love your neighbour as yourself. While at the heart of the Christian gospel is self-giving love, Christianity does not promote the altruism of Auguste Comte's positivism, the religion of humanity of the 19th century, in which the good of others is the only goal of moral action. Christian love is about reciprocity and communion, so our own flourishing matters too. And as I stated at the beginning of this lecture, paradoxically ensured in seeking the good of other people. Relationality is the nature of the persons of the Godhead in the Christian idea of the Trinity. And this characterizes our own life as the church, Christ's body, and should inform our social action. A just world will be one in which relations of justice will be reciprocal, as they are, in fact, in way back in Aristotle himself, and balanced like the pans of the scales held by the figure of justice herself. You can contrast this with policies such as carbon trading or the congestion charge in cities. In both cases, the environment benefits to a variable extent, but reciprocity is lessened and the poor often miss out. And preference for the poor is another key element of Catholic social teaching. Congestion charging too often benefits the rich, who can just pay and drive. Or if it's one of those cities where you can only drive on a Monday and Wednesday in a particular car, they just have two cars. And it punishes those who need to use a van for work. And the rich avoid personal responsibility for their actions, which is even more true of carbon offloaders. In carbon trading, big users of fossil fuels buy credits to carry on emitting, while other countries or groups institute carbon reductions and earn money from selling carbon offsets. This sounds reciprocal, but it's not as just as it appears. We've had the Clean Development Mechanism, as it's called, since the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, but emissions have carried on rising. The reason is that CDM allows the big companies to carry on emitting and does not drive substantial carbon reduction because they're not required to make radical changes. Less developed countries do not benefit as well as they should from a marketized approach to carbon pricing, which is often artificially low. Furthermore, several recent studies have found frequently a mismatch between claims of things like reforesting and the actual effect on local people, such as thoughtless extensive tree planting, which reduced the water table to such an extent local farmers couldn't grow any crops. Moreover, much of carbon offsetting in the rainforest is about not cutting any more trees. You know, it's just sort of stopping, it's not. And very often the claims overestimate the cost of this in fraudulent ways. There are lots of examples of this. And the whole idea of carbon trading reduces personal and company responsibility, while the less developed country is still affected by the climate changes and often by the pollution caused. It is not a moral market. By contrast, relationality has been a crucial element of renewable forms of energy in some countries. In 1981, residents of the Danish island of Aero, if I pronounced it correctly, got together to establish an energy and environmental office. And 650 of them invested in a wind farm, profits from which are mainly ploughed back into the community. They now have three solar hydrogen plants and the world's first electric ferry. Such local cooperatives for energy projects were encouraged by earlier Danish policies, so that by 2000, 84% of wind capacity was communally owned. Although Denmark had gone back on these policies since, although they've gone back on these policies, since 2011, 20% of all wind farms must be communally owned. This means that communities come together and improve their cohesion and cooperation. They see the fruits of their investment in projects and support for local shops, for example, as well as their own pockets. And they do not then regard the wind farm as an imposition. Now Denmark makes 67% of its electricity from renewable sources, and this will be 240% in 8 years' time. Scotland has a number of cooperative ventures of this sort. The island of Tiree has surplus electricity, which it sells. It can finance extra social care for the elderly, and its financial and energy buoyancy helps to attract new residents to revivify this small community. And if all this sounds relatively easy to achieve on watery, windy islands like the Orkney chain, where they produce 120% of energy from renewables and are about to run a ferry on hydrogen, Brixton in London has its own group of energy cooperatives. Of modest size, they've yet to put solar panels on three areas of social housing and offer internships on developing storage capacity. They offer solar panel waking workshops and have branched out into a number of what we would call common goods: public banking, local food chains, and worker cooperatives. In these examples, where community benefit is at the heart, environmental benefit and social benefit go hand in hand, and what Gaston Fessard called the common good of mutual communion is enjoyed. In the Netherlands, community batteries have played a part in enabling renewable electricity. For one problem about renewable energy is that it's stored differently and very large batteries and grid capacity are required. And people will tell you, we haven't got a hope of getting it in Britain in the short term. And this brings its own justice questions, because batteries need rare metals, often mined by forced and even child labour. But individual home and community batteries and local sources mean smaller, simpler, nimbler grids can operate, not needing to communicate necessarily to larger systems. And they need far less in terms of resources. and soon battery recycling will mean less lithium and other metals will be required. They think they can cut them by 50% by recycling batteries, and these local communities are aiming to do that. This is all much more sustainable and again allows local people to have agency and give mutual support and cuts the cost of electricity. The theological principle of operation in all my positive examples is that of subsidiarity, which was nicely defined by Benedict XVI as the coordination of society's activities in a way that supports the internal life of the local communities. He links it to the development of responsibility, in which as many as possible can take part in decision making. The classic definition is found in Quadragesimo Anno of Pius XI. It's an injustice and at the same time a grave evil and disturbance of right order to assign to a greater and higher association what lesser and subordinate organisations can do. For every social activity ought of its very nature to furnish help to the members of the body social and never destroy and absorb them. If we're to balance and unify our social and environmental needs, we're going to need action at the local level. And this also then makes sure, for example, one of the trade union leaders recently, I read an article in the New Statesman, I think he's the Gasfitters Union, was saying, well, you know, all the green jobs are going to China. So, you know, local people are not benefiting from the work. Whereas if you're working with these smaller institutions, they will make sure, because they are so much more relational, that they think through the whole circle of work to make sure that, you know, that though, of course, you've got to train people to do it. But of course, that Brixton example was doing exactly that. We also need lesser and subordinate organisations to enable this. I've already given some examples of energy cooperatives and food pantries, which instantiate the Anglican Christian socialism principles of F.D. Morris, Ludlow and Kingsley in the 19th century of cooperation as the social representation of the divine order. Yet just when we need arenas where we can act together face to face and seek justice, such intermediate institutions are in crisis. Trade union membership, for example, is only 23% of all workers, lowest figure since research began. The numbers belonging to political parties have similarly fallen catastrophically since the 50s. Churches have shared in this free fall. But they have resources other groups lack. First, the theological ideas I've been describing, if they use them. And secondly, buildings and communities all over the United Kingdom. And this is true of other faith groups as well, who often get together in citizens' groups and so on. And these groups are all dedicated to reconciliation and the common good, which could be of great use to us in our present crisis. For telling people the facts about climate change, species depletion, and carbon emissions does not alone drive changes in behaviour. It might mean people do their recycling conscientiously, but it hasn't stopped the volume of holiday air travel. Even a suggestion of a universal 20 miles an hour speed limit in towns and villages is greeted with horror, despite the fact that evidence shows it would make the traffic flow more efficiently, so you might actually do less stop starting and use less petrol, reduce emissions and save lives. Subsidiarity for Catholics and Anglicans alike can be found in the concept of parish, which, while it might be under stress in practical terms of affording or attracting enough clergy, especially in Lincolnshire, it has potency as an image of a kind of belonging, of stability and inclusivity, of the importance of the level at which we relate face to face and can begin to embody the principles I described. Parish is particularly attractive as an idea to ecologists. Richard Mabey, in his introduction to Gilbert White's Natural History of Selborne, coined the term parochial ecology, to describe his own practice, which is to attend to the local and the ordinary. Robert McFarlane has similarly owned the term and wishes to rescue it from its associations with provincialism and insularity. Their attention, particularly Mabey's, is to the urban railway siding as much as the country lane. And Bob Gilbert in Ghost Trees has studied the natural world and the supermarket car parks and other unpromising places in a North London parish. What they articulate is a new conception of parish, so that it encompasses not just people, but also creatures, plants and stones. It's a local form of Pope Francis's integral ecology. Or as what Mabey describes as, I quote, the indefinable territory to which we belong, which we have the measure of. Its boundaries are more the limits of our intimate allegiances than lines on a map. These allegiances have always embraced wildlife as well as human. The naturalists I've been describing all extend these gifts to the natural world. And we too, as Christians, know that we are fellow creatures and have allegiances with other natural forms. Indeed, we're all natural, and only God is supernatural. And creatures, as Aquinas taught, are marked in some way with the divine qualities and share his image to some extent. This means it's a category mistake to pit nature versus the needs of the poor, for they are necessarily united. Secondly, it means that in working for a juster world, we begin where we are, parochially, in the ecosystems we inhabit, and we move outwards. We each of us live what Merlin Sheldrake describes as an entangled life in community with and dependence on plants, birds, earth and water where we live. Sheldrake has shown how fungi heal our bodies and even soak up carbon. As Laudato Si puts it, the human person grows more, matures more and is sanctified more to the extent that he or she enters into relationships, going out from themselves to live in communion with God, with others, and all creatures. And I think particularly of a wonderful little film I saw last week of Ethiopian Christians. The only forest that survives in Ethiopia is round churches, because Ethiopian Christians believe that every church is, if you like, the Garden of Eden before the fall. And so they preserved the forests. So the way back to sustainability for Ethiopia is to use these as the kind of banks to move out from. But the Ethiopian Christians believe they have a relationship with the trees. We need to build this relationality into our policy making at every level and include the inanimate creation in our concept of creaturehood. Christ said in Luke 19, if his disciples were silenced, the stones would cry out. The poet Mandy Hopkins compares Blessed Mary to the air we breathe, appropriately, for the atmosphere itself is a common good. The 17th century Anglican poet Henry Vaughan developed this agency of nature in his poem, The Bird. All things that be praise him and had their lesson taught them when first made. So hills and valleys into singing break. And though poor stones have neither speech nor tongue, while active winds and streams both run and speak, yet stones are deep in admiration. Wonder. This theology of creation is a particularly British inheritance in our poetry and theology, encompassing both the Anglican Wordsworth and the Catholic Hopkins. It should help us to develop a more holistic understanding of our relation to nature and each other, sharing that good of mutual communion. If we are to save our world and its poor, I believe it will come from applying all these ideas of Catholic social teaching I've been describing parochially and locally, so as to include the natural world in the common good, in dignity, in subsidiarity and solidarity. Francis says about solidarity, it entails weaving a fabric of fraternal relationships marked by reciprocity, forgiveness and complete self-giving, according to the breadth and depth of the love of God offered to humanity in the one who, crucified and risen, draws all to himself. Targets can only take us so far. They are not ultimate goals. Humans will only bring about a just world from a teleological vision of the flourishing of all things in Christ and through positive delight in and appreciation of the natural world where we live, which the naturalist Gilbert White had so deeply he could stand all night watching the movements of toads. Elaine Scarry, in her book on beauty and being just, argues it is from our appreciation of the beautiful that we learn true justice as it provokes us to care and protect. And it's noteworthy, the only two organisations that have grown in Britain are the National Trust and the Royal Institute for the Protection of Birds, both concerned with appreciation and conservation, recognition of beauty and care. Well, a just world and a peaceable one seems far from us right now, but we shouldn't lose that most theological virtue of hope. Through acting at the local and parochial level imaginatively, in small ways that bear within them the good for people and the good for nature, we can contribute to the common good and inspire others to join us as we learn to model virtuous circles. Indeed, wherever you live, from Blackburn to Banborough, there will be people to join in with, of all faiths and none, seeking the common good. Perhaps gardening on roundabouts, or supporting mental health schemes with animal care, running cooking clubs in women's refuges, or butterfly counting in churchyards. When life is precarious, we need each other more than ever, and to realise, as D.H. Lawrence put it, that we are all of us, from stones to people, creatures in the house of the God of life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alistair. That was absolutely wonderful. You've given us a very rich presentation with lots to reflect on and to respond to. So we're now moving into the Q&A section of proceedings. And please, everyone, remember that you can submit your questions in the Q&A function on Zoom or on the chat on Facebook or YouTube. And I wonder if I could perhaps, to get us going, ask the first question, Alison, and if you'd reflect a bit further on the implications of what you said for the parish. And here, I wonder if you could sort of bring together your involvement in Save the Parish with what you said, and perhaps reflect on some of the parishes in rural areas of rural poverty, where people are just struggling to keep the roof on and keep the door open. And how, in those sorts of situations, those communities can seek the common good in relation to climate change, not least as what they can do as a sort of as a community, often a very small worshipping community in that place, but also in relation to their building.
That's a really good question, because one of the really sad things at the moment that I was speaking about to somebody before this session. Well, it's not sad. It's really, really good that the Church of England wants to have eco-parishes. And the work of our Rosha here is absolutely crucial. But it's being done through targets. We need to be carbon neutral by 2030. And this can seem to a little rural parish that, as Simon said, is struggling to keep the roof on, like the law in St. Paul, which, you know, judges you. I know that the law isn't really like this, but anyway, it sometimes seemed to him that the law set him up to fail and he hadn't a hope of managing it. And that's really sad. And this is why I'm trying to suggest that the way is through positive, to begin with the love of what you are and where you are. So one of the things that the common good Common Ground Charity of Richard Mabey suggests is that in a parish, you should make a parish map. And that doesn't mean just a geographical map. It means a map of allegiances, maps of, you know, if you're in an urban area, it might be where all the young people congregate, where the drug dealers are, where the lovely parts that you that give you pleasure, where you were born. You know, you make a map that is an emotional and allegiances map, and you also map nature into that so that you begin by appreciation. And anyone can do that, even three old ladies and a dog. In fact, they're well placed to start that kind of thing. And then you begin to value and work out what you value. So there are these projects of things like butterfly counting in churchyards. Then you begin to think, how can we conserve the good things that we do have in terms of the natural world? Then you begin to think about the challenges that face you. And obviously money is one of those. But there are ways of thinking creatively. And thank God the Church of England is now, instead of leaving parishes to sort of just cope, they are beginning to suggest more innovative ways forward. So, for example, there are quite cheap ways in which you can heat the person rather than the building, which in the case of one rural parish have actually saved the money on their heating bills. They have a battery pack, which you can just use off a normal plug, so you don't need phase three or whatever it is in electricity. And you charge your cushions and then people sit on them. And I gather they work and you save money. So you begin to think, how can we think creatively? And if you're warmer in church, this will actually help your mission, because there's nothing worse than inviting people to a building that is absolutely freezing, even if there's a warm welcome. So we need to move away from seeing targets as impositions towards starting with appreciation and then thinking of challenge. But I mean, there are all sorts of things that you can do locally, though it's not helped by pastoral reorganisation, because that is unecological, because there's hardly any rural bus transport on a Sunday. So that expecting people to leave their parishes to go, in the case of Cornwall, they might have to go up to 30 miles to church is unecological. So it's not being helped by these kind of policies. We really need to think and live locally. Clergy need to go around on bicycles, you know, rather than sort of setting everything up to be distant. We need to find ways to do things locally. And I'm not trying to solve all the problems of the Church of England, but I think it begins with appreciation. It begins with loss and lament. For example, in my son-in-law's rural Lincolnshire parish, there used to be a place that grew bird's eye peas, and women were able to do that work. They used to take their prams out in the fields with them and feed their babies in between. So it was a source of work for them. And that's all been lost as everything has become mechanised. And I think that's important as well, that you're a place of memory and lament, and then seeing what's going on locally. It doesn't mean that the church needs to run everything, but there will be things going on locally. I know there are farmers, for example, planting wildflowers around all the fields in Lincolnshire, which will obviously help pollination, help the yields, and improve the environment for everybody. So that's the other way, that the parish should be an ecological reality, which starts with contemplation, moves through wonder and lament to think and join in with what's going on locally. Sorry.
That's great. Thank you, Alison. We've got quite a few questions coming in.
Yep.
So I'm going to start with this one from Doug from South Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. So he says, there is a tension in the climate debate between the need to take action and the need to ensure people retain dignity as we move towards a new reality. Mm-hmm. But in many communities during the 1980s, there were standoffs between Thatcher government and the miners. Mm-hmm. How do we avoid this and ensure that communities, like many former mining communities who still have not recovered, are not left behind?
That's a really good point. Because the mining did give people dignity. And these are were very, very strong communities. And in my county that I come from, Nottinghamshire, there are still tensions which were represented in that wonderful Sherwood television programme, everybody saw it, between people who went on strike and people who went back, that still survive to this day. I mean, it's partly a matter of the problem of ex-mining villages generally, that there haven't always been things coming to take the place of the mining. There have, of course, been some places where the slag heaps have been turned into parks and things like that, but it's whether they bring jobs. Now, the green economy will bring jobs. It will bring lots of jobs. The problem is how you make sure that those jobs are done locally, and that partly means that the government doesn't outsource its buying in of things to China and do it just on purely economic criteria, because it may seem cheaper to pay for this from outside. You're then going to have to pay employment benefit to the people who are not working. So a virtuous circle would actually bring that kind of technology here. We actually developed some of the best technology in waves, particularly. But as usual, we don't fund long-term, whatever parties in power, we don't fund long-term projects. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of innovation, but it goes elsewhere. So the only answer to that, well, part of the answer is if you can do things. When I say locally, I don't mean in a town, but, you know, in a region, say, that they could club together to, you know, if you're in a metropolitan area where you've got a mayor, you do have some resources that you could work regionally on this. And I think, you know, people like trade unions have a role here. But that's the main tension, isn't it? That it will bring jobs, but those jobs have to come here. And that the only way for that is either to organise locally or to put pressure on the government.
Well, there is a question that directly addresses
trying
that,
to sort the world
which is that you have given us a wonderful vision of people asserting human agency through community in the local. But don't you agree that there's actually a need for a national industrial strategy? Where government actually centrally incentivises the reshoring of manufacturing to create green jobs, not at random where capital chooses to go, but where, for example, in those former mining communities that have been abandoned for over four decades.
Of course.
So an industrial strategy?
Of course you need an industrial strategy. Mm. I mean, this isn't a substitute. But it's just, I can't sort that one out. I can say to governments, you have become managers. You are no longer politicians. Aristotle thought that politics was that you got all the virtues in order to exercise them in the political realm. Politics should be a site of virtue, and people should be rewarded. This is very much my husband and Adrian Papst's kind of line. People should be rewarded for virtuous behaviour so that you have more moral markets, so you'd have politicians who will begin to look at long-term strategies. But until we can make that happen, it's difficult. But if we start locally, I would hope that, you know, I have a local council. People vote for people on that local council, not by what party they're in, but because they know them. So we have a wonderful mixture of people. And I can never quite remember what party they do belong to, that they do mostly belong to parties, because they're people and they act for the common good. And we need to get that up the levels, but there need to be ways to build virtue into these systems. in order for it to happen.
But it's partly what you're saying about subsidiarity, isn't it? The where responsibility lies. There are key responsibilities at government level and at regional and local and so on. So I've got another question. This is from Anne, and she says, the church has led the discussion on caring for our environment for years. We've been talking about it through the lens of care of creation, and charities like CAFOD have used the language like live simply. But as our church populations become increasingly middle class, the environmental issue within church circles is undertaken from a middle class perspective. So how can we change this to ensure a broader discussion on the environment within our churches?
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because obviously it is much easier if you can afford to buy organic food or sort of shirts made out of sea wool, as came in the door the other day. And yet, I think we're going to have to come. This is not the churches, this is the nation. In the end, the only fair thing that is going to change behaviour is that we have some kind of rationing, which will be much fairer on the poor.
But don't you think also that the narrative, if it's shifted to include jobs and livelihoods, is more likely to appeal to people? Who are working people, people who you're calling poor communities. I think part of the problem is that the narrative is always around the natural world and these kind of consumer-based methods that people can take to contribute their role in mitigating climate change. But to people who are working or who have very little money, that's meaningless. And so they're likely to be alienated. So if the narrative can shift to actually becoming the integral ecology you were talking about, where we're addressing people's livelihoods that often are at risk by the fast pace of climate change.
I mean, we need to move away from being, everybody is a consumer and everybody is a producer. And perhaps poorer people are more seeing themselves in a producer role because work is, if you're doing two jobs, you come home and a consumer approach isn't going to save the world. It does have to have...
There's an image that always sticks in my mind from a couple of years ago of a situation in London Tube Station with a climate change activist on the roof with a banner.
Oh, yes.
And the people on the platform shouting for him to get off the roof so they could get to work.
Yes.
And it's that tension, I think, that we've got really stuck with, that, and the church has got mixed up in that as well, because the church has become so middle class.
And so much focused on individual behaviour, which obviously matters, but it isn't, again, you can turn it into a kind of virtue signalling kind of approach. It is about justice. Though I still think that, just because, in fact, I know a parish in Paulsgrove, in a council estate outside Portsmouth, that has had a lot of problems over the years, and there are a lot of people there who are economically quite deprived. But they've had enormous delight out of making a community garden. That has been very important for, people there. And it's part of their sense of self-worth that this is a place. In fact, they've now got a slogan, which I can't remember what it is, but it's got Paulsgrove in it and it's something really positive. That their sort of green policies involve things like repair workshops, where people can bring stuff and other people repair it. Not necessarily beautiful like the things on television, more like sort of a toaster or people who can't afford to. They brought justice and the green thing, they're all part of the same project. And I think that's quite important, where, people are helped economically as well as saving stuff.
Got another question.
Yeah.
Paul Kingsnorth from the Christian Eastern Orthodox tradition writes powerfully about the reality of what he calls the machine, the collusion between technocratic government and big corporation power that imposes sustainability, in inverted commas, as a way of centralising power.
Yeah.
Things like the universalising of farming practices and so on, which circumvents the democratic process. So with this increasing power and commercial interest at play, how can we assert local agency?
I mean, it would be helpful to have a kind of example. I mean, I think it's about sort of particularly what he means by universal farming practice. I know what Paul Kingsolve means about the machine. You know, everything is connected, and agency is taken, according to this view, away from governments themselves towards these kind of big companies. And obviously, the bigger the company you are, you'll have your green side, and you'll be a kind of driving it. And again, you'll be driving where things are made and where the jobs are. Gosh, how do you deal with this?
I mean, without withdrawing from modernity altogether, you know, how do we live in the world and engage and yet recognise the power?
Showing it up is one thing we can do, where we find it impinging. Mm. Where it impinges on your own life, you need to go public about it and you need to tell people about it.
Well, what you were saying about the common good earlier, where through relationship, people coming together and retaining that human space as a means of resistance against what I would call the modern pharaohs of these great powers. I mean, that's one way, isn't it, that the church in the local can help to strengthen local relationships as a form of resistance?
Yes, all local relationships, because all relationships are a common good. Mm. And the coming together of all the different anybody who is prepared to sort of join together in a group has the potential to join with other groups in terms of resistance. That's what I'm saying. You know, we're all precarious. Mm. We're all vulnerable. All institutions are on the edge at the moment in this ludicrously individualist world that we live in, which is making everybody sick. Mm-hmm. I once worked out that nearly all my tutees were, you know, either having treatment for anxiety, depression, or something like this. It's not helping people. Mm. So the answer is coming together as a good in itself and making alliances as much as you can.
One last question.
Yeah.
The local examples you've drawn on are very hopeful, and your argument for change at the most local level is compelling. The scale of the climate crisis, however, is huge. So what are the national policies that would most support and encourage local initiatives in the volume that's inevitably necessary to meet the scale of the challenge?
Well, I think the Danish example, which obviously they went back from under pressure from big companies, where until 2000, all the projects were locally owned, we could do that. Sometimes some of these local initiatives did have to partner up at the beginning to get the technology. But then they are in a position of being able to bargain, particularly if, you know, you get every area in the southeast that's going to do their own thing. They get together as a group and then they can begin to put pressure on the company to do things their way a bit, because then they are a kind of client. And yet they're working locally. So governments can do that very easily. And it would help in so many ways, because I said, once they have these little local things, they're able to, you know, to increase the social care of the elderly, to support their local shops, to put money into sort of first start equivalent centres and things like this with what they have, and to empower people financially out of it and to create jobs. But they have to do it in their own way. So I would have thought subsidiarity is the way forward for governments. And also it puts some of the responsibility off the government in a way. and onto local people. So it's a bit of a risk, but I think we're up to it.
That's a great place to stop. Thank you so much.
And thank you for these brilliant questions. I'm sorry, they're such big, important questions.
So over to you, Simon.
Alison, for an absolutely fantastic lecture, and also for the way in which you've responded to all those questions, which have covered a whole range of issues related to what you said. And I'm sorry it hasn't been possible for us to ask all the questions that people have submitted. And on behalf of the Cathedral, I also want to thank Together for the Common Good. At a time of transition in the life of the Cathedral here at Lincoln, we're very keen to look outwards as much as possible, as well as forwards. And tonight's lecture and all the lectures in this series have really been a wonderful resource to help us to do that. And so we're very grateful. And I'd also like to thank CCLA again for supporting this series. CCLA is the UK's leading sustainability fund manager for charities, faith and public sector organisations with a long history of making assets to Christian organisations. And we really appreciate your support. Jenny, over to you.
Thank you, Simon. So just to thank you, Alison, again. This has been superb and a great provocation. Thank you for kicking off our common good conversation to approach this issue in a different, more creative way. And thank you, everyone, for being with us tonight. The recording and the text of Alison's lecture will be online in a day or two, so please do share it more widely to get more people engaged. And looking forward, the 8th and final lecture in this series will be on Monday, the 27th of November at 6:30 with Sister Helen Alford, who I've asked to talk about social peace and the causes of division, to explore the common good approach to the cultural confusion of our time. And you can book your place for that on togetherforthecommongood.co.uk and at the Lincoln Cathedral website in due course when the booking is ready. So I hope you'll join us for that. And so just remains to say thank you, Alison, again. And thank you, Simon, for joining us. And thank you to everybody watching. Good night and God bless.